Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, The Pope and the People. A report on Pope Francis's general audience, where he talked about charity and Christian love and warned against the many forms of hypocritical love. How the papacy changed Rome. We explore some of the famous and less well-known ways in which past popes changed the face of the Eternal City, not just on the religious and cultural front, but also its infrastructure. The woman at the well. We have a Lenten reflection focusing on the biblical account of the Samaritan woman and her outcast status. And angelic songs. We end with a musical meditation by Monsignor Whitmore, who looks at music that was described as songs for angels to sing in heaven. As normal, we begin our programme with a report on Pope Francis's general audience, where he spoke about charity and the nature of true Christian love, warning that hypocritical love is worse than hate. Linda Bordoni reports.
To the over 12,000 pilgrims gathered in a sunny St. Peter's Square, Pope Francis said that he who loves has the joy of hope, because one day he will be united with the Lord, the source of all love. Reflecting on readings from Matthew and from St. Paul, the Pope focused on what he described as our vocation for love and charity. He warned against the risk of a hypocritical love, which he said can be tainted by self-interest, and urged the faithful not to be tempted to carry out works of charity driven by the desire to put themselves on show, seeking visibility and approval.
Quanto bravo sono, no? Questa ipocrisia.
It's important, he said, to remember that love is a grace. It is a gift that God is happy to give us if we ask for it. It is a grace that forgives our sins, heals our hearts, and enables us to become channels of the Lord's own unconditional love. We can become instruments of God's love, he explained, when we allow ourselves to be healed and renewed by the resurrected Christ. So conscious of our human weaknesses, he urged the faithful to ask our Lord daily to renew the gift of his love within us and to enable us to be witnesses of that love to others, especially to those in greatest need. After the catechesis, Pope Francis blessed the crowds and turned to a group of employees of the Italian branch of the TV platform Sky, which is undergoing change and downsizing. He expressed his hope for a solution that takes into account the respect for the rights of all, saying work gives dignity.
Lavoro ci dà dignità.
He said, who shuts factories and closes companies as a result of economic operations and negotiations, depriving men and women from work, commits a very grave sin.
Fa un peccato gravissimo.
I'm Linda Bordoni.
Quanto sei bella Roma, quanto sei bella Roma.
Rome is one of the world's most popular tourist destinations, with an average of around 14 million tourists and pilgrims flocking to the Eternal City each year to admire its spiritual and architectural wonders and its wealth of history. Everyone knows that without the papacy, there would be no St. Peter's Basilica or Vatican museums to visit. But far fewer tourists realise that without the foresight and vision of past popes, a large number of Rome's other historical monuments, like the Colosseum or the Pantheon, would almost certainly have fallen into complete ruin or been destroyed. Other examples of the many papal contributions were the building of Rome's straight roads, hospitals, fountains, and the opening of the world's first ever public museum on the city's Capitoline Hill. To find out more about some of these famous and less well-known ways in which the papacy changed the face of Rome over the past centuries, I sat down with Liz Lev, who teaches Christian art and architecture at several universities in the Eternal City.
Well, the Colosseum, if you think about it, it's a pretty problematic monument for the Christian world. I mean, this is a building that was set up simply for an entertainment of blood sport. Why on earth would the Christians take any interest in preserving something that...
Where they would be thrown to the lions.
I mean, on top of everything else, there is a history of the martyrdoms in the Colosseum. So why would you go to the trouble of keeping a building that was set up to represent the absolute worst of the Roman Empire? And at the beginning, the church wasn't in a position to take care of it. When the fall of the Roman Empire, the church had no authority to take care of it, no resources. And so for many years, the Colosseum was actually used as housing. It was taken over as a private family fortress by the Frangipani family, of all things, in the 11th century.
And how long did they live there?
They lived there. Actually, they had it for several hundred years, and they used it as kind of their own private stronghold in Rome. They were dismissed from that stronghold in around 1300s, and then it was hit by an earthquake. So the Colosseum was struck by an earthquake in 1349, which crumbled the entire southern wall, popped the seats out. And so what do you see there? An ancient building that serves no function whatsoever, but it has a giant bunch of cut stones on the ground. And in the beginning, in the 1400s, everybody took those cut stones to rebuild things, including St. Peter's. So yes, at the beginning, the papacy used these bits of travertine on the ground to help build what was going to be a far greater and more noble building, which is St. Peter's. But as the years went by and that building began to be picked away, and gradually the original surface was disappearing, and the memory of this great piece of engineering was about to be lost, the popes turned around on their position and they said, wait a minute, this is a martyrium. It's a site where Christians had died. This is 1754. And secondly, this is a memory of the great achievements of the Romans in engineering and a reminder of the kinds of things that these people were willing, the lengths that people were willing to go to for entertainment. And so they protected the building. They declared no more quarrying. It was to be preserved as a martyrium.
So which pope was it that was responsible for ordering the building of those wedges, which basically support it?
Exactly. So in 1815, Pius VII, who has a ton on his plate, he has just spent an entire pontificate dealing with the ravages of Napoleon. On top of everything else, in the last years of his papacy, he looks to the Colosseum and realizes it needs emergency restoration maneuvers. So he begins the wedge that will hold up the Colosseum. Anybody who's seen the Colosseum sees the white travertine arches, and then there's a brick wedge, which is still holding it up to this day. And on the other side, his successor, Gregory XVI, because Pius VII died almost immediately afterwards, Gregory XVI completed it with the other wedge. And the papacy continued to take care of that building over the years until finally the Italian government took over, and now they watch over the Colosseum.
Now, another of Rome's most popular tourist destinations is the Pantheon. It's one of its best preserved historical monuments, very ancient. Tell us a bit about that. I mean, you said it was built in the swampy lands of the Campus Martius, right?
Well, I think your most important statement is one of the best preserves. Who do people think preserved these buildings? When we have the barbarian invasions, we have utter poverty, we have destitution, we have a population that goes from 800,000 in 330 with Constantine to 25,000 between 700 and 800. And yet the church found it in itself to take hold of these buildings, to watch over these buildings, to allow them the privilege of becoming churches so that they would survive to this day. So, for example, Senate House became a church. That's why we can still visit the ancient Roman Curia. The Temple of Antoninus Pius and Faustina became a church. The Temple of Portus.
And the Pantheon, then, which pope was responsible
and
there?
And the Pantheon is the first one. The church did not want to take these pagan buildings. First of all, structurally, they were small, dark, and they had pagan god cooties, so who wanted them anyway? But the Pantheon was special. The Pantheon was an extraordinarily beautiful building, a monument to human genius. And so on May 13th of 609, Pope Boniface IV asked the Byzantine emperor, because it was not his city to control, he asked the Byzantine emperor to give him the Pantheon so that the Pantheon could continue to live as a church, where it would be cared for, where it would be watched over, where it would be restored under the funding and attention of the Catholic Church. And that is why so many tourists have that wonderful photo op, that magnificent experience, which if they think about it, it's free. Who pays a ticket to go into the Pantheon? You put that church anywhere else in the world and you pay a ticket to go into Hagia Sophia, but you don't pay a ticket to go into the Pantheon because it's a gift.
Okay, so we've looked at the Colosseum and the Pantheon, the two of the perhaps top historical monuments, but what other monuments have we to thank the papacy for in the past where they've stepped in and stopped a monument from crumbling to ruin?
Really, there's so many comforts that the tourist takes in for granted when one comes to Rome. And I take so for granted that when I go to other cities, I'm always surprised. I don't have a nice, cool church I can sit in and just read my map and get my bearings and try to figure out where to go. And yet, what have we got? 900 churches open in the morning, open in the afternoon, the papal basilicas open all day long, always a place where you can go and sit and be quiet with, as I said, free bathrooms. And then you have the water fountains. You don't necessarily have to buy a €3 bottle of water. You can get yourself a bottle and you can fill it up from our hundreds upon hundreds of free fountains. That idea, which began in ancient Rome under the great pagan aristocrats who built the first aqueducts, was picked up by the papacy in the 1400s, and they were strategic fountains placed throughout the city so that pilgrims on their way here who were tired, who were thirsty, who were lost, they could take a few minutes, have a sip of water, rinse off their hands and feet, and was just there, no charge.
And all these really famous fountains, like the Trevi Fountain, or the fountain in Piazza Navona, and of course at the Spanish Steps, they were all built thanks to
the papacy. Again, it's not only is there the useful, but there's the aesthetic. Not only is it a wonderful gift to be able to find fresh, cold water, but the papacy took this and made them into beautiful spaces. The Trevi Fountain begun, there's an idea under Urban VIII, completed with Clement the 14th. You find Urban VIII, who gave us the Triton Fountain, the Piazza Navona Fountain, which was from Innocent X Pamphili. Urban VIII also gave us the fountain in the Piazza di Spagna, in the Turtle Fountain, in the edges of the ghetto. All of these fountains, always gifts of the papacy.
And another gift of the papacy, of course, is its straight roads. I mean, I know it's got quite a labyrinth of little roads in the historical centre, but there's a lot of very straight thoroughfares that cross through the city that link the holy sites. Tell us something about how those came to pass.
Well, again, with sort of the complicated vicissitudes of the fall of the Roman Empire and the shifting of the remaining Roman survivors, if you will, into what we call the Campus Martius. That's the area around the Pantheon and the Piazza Navona. In that kind of complicated shift, people just built willy-nilly. And they're just a little, anybody who's ever walked around that area is always lost. I think those of us who've been here for 100 years, we're also lost. But when it came to connecting the major gates of the city to the major monuments, the papacy realized that pilgrims were coming in either walking through an urban design that looked like it was put together by a planner looking into a plate of spaghetti, or they were walking through a cornfield going, you know, is there a city in here someplace? Oddly enough, it's the Pope's names Sixtus, who are always builders. So when you get a Pope named Sixtus, he's going to be building. Sixtus the Third, Sixtus the Fourth, Sixtus the Fifth. They gave us roads, they gave us churches, and they gave us very clear, straight thoroughfares so that the pilgrim, the person who wasn't a native, could be able to see from a distance where he was going or she was going, so that visiting the churches and the holy sites was not aggravated, or the difficulties that they already had were not aggravated by trying to find your way. I mean, before there were street maps that you could buy for, you know, a dime a dozen, before there was, you know, a GPS system on your phone, how do you think people get around? And these long, straight streets marked with obelisks.
Yes, the obelisks. I wanted to pick up on that.
What a wonderful idea.
Who first got that idea?
It was Sixtus the Fifth, again, 1585 to 1590, and his first obelisk move was in 1586 when he took the intact obelisk by the side of St. Peter's, the silent witness. That obelisk has been there since Peter died looking at it. And he moved it in an incredibly elaborate project from the side of St. Peter's to the front of St. Peter's. So the obelisk would be a beacon. This is the witness of where Peter died. Back here is where Peter is buried. And here you will see the successor of St. Peter, the church alive and kicking still today.
And a great landmark for tourists, particularly in areas where there were much lower buildings.
Particularly, so it made it very easy, but also the one in St. Mary Major, the one in front of St. John Lateran. Later on, they'll put one on top of the Spanish Steps and the Piazza del Popolo. It makes it so easy. You look in the distance going, where am I going? Oh, obelisk. Well, there's got to be something important there.
Let's turn now to museums. And we all know, of course, that we have the papacy to thank for this amazing collection of art housed in the Vatican museums. But I'm sure not many people know, I didn't know, that it was a pope who opened the world's first public museum in 1471 in Rome's Capitoline Hill. Tell us a bit about how that happened.
Well, as an art historian and a Catholic, I am profoundly proud of this, that the very first public museum was opened by Sixtus IV in 1471. He had great plans to take Rome and turn it into a new Caput Mundi, a new head of the world, not in the pagan sense, but in a new Christian sense. He was building roads and libraries. He was opening up aqueducts. He was building the first bridge to cross the Tiber. And he realized that he needed the Roman people to be with him, not against him. So he took five bronze statues, which had been lovingly kept at St. John Lateran for centuries, protected through the sacks and the things over the years that had happened, and he gave those five statues on the top of the Capitoline Hill in this palace known as the Conservator's Palace. He gave these to the Roman people so the Romans could look upon their glorious past, their beautiful artwork, their great rulers, their remarkable achievements, and they could hope to have a glorious future. What a wonderful motive for a museum. He's the one who even gave us that image of the she-wolf with the two children as our symbol of Rome. That wasn't the symbol of Rome. The symbol of Rome in antiquity was SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romanus, Senate and People of Rome. And it was Sixtus who took that she-wolf, commissioned the two baby statues. They're so familiar to everyone underneath it, in a completely different spirit. A she-wolf. Who on earth would leave their kids with a she-wolf? I mean, that merits a call to child services now, doesn't it?
And there were other gifts given, weren't there, to this museum later on, weren't there, from the Pope?
The papacy continued to gift that museum, endow that museum with wonderful works of art. There was a huge exodus from the Vatican museums under Pius V, which just sent hundreds of works over into the Capitoline. That some of the more famous works, I think the ones that people would recognize are the wonderful Dying Gaul, perhaps one of the most statuesque and noble of the sculptures.
The Capitoline Aurelius.
And the Marcus Aurelius, which was brought over although that was actually put in the piazza, it only went to the museum in 2000, but it was brought over to that area under Paul III.
So all these came from the popes.
Exactly.
I also wanted to look at the hospitals in Rome. As you say, it's not just the culture and everything, but it's also about, taking care of people. I mean, Rome has been a centre of pilgrimage for so many centuries. The past popes did a lot on the hospital front, didn't they?
The papacy was very interested, not only, Sixtus IV in particular was deeply concerned about not only the well-being of the Roman people, but those many, many, many people who came to Rome as pilgrims. And so he built his hospital, which is the Santo Spirito, literally right next door to us. He built the Santo Spirito Hospital with its very modern-looking wards. It was very much a pave-the-way sort of hospital at the time. And then at the same time, they also built a hospice, or in the sense of, that word I always need to qualify a bit, in the sense of a place for pilgrims to be able to find food, meal, help, assistance of some sort. And so that was known as Trinità dei Pellegrini, the Church of the Trinities, or the Trinity for the Pilgrims. And that's right by the Ponte Sisto, right by the bridge that crosses to Trastevere. And that was the number one place where you would kind of keep an eye on how many pilgrims were coming, because that was the place that most pilgrims knew to go to stay.
I was speaking to Liz Lebb, teacher of Christian art and architecture at the Rome campus of Duquesne University. The biblical account of Jesus' meeting with the Samaritan woman at the well is the theme of our latest Lenten reflection by Father Colm Kelly, a chaplain with the Apostleship of the Sea, the Church's maritime agency. Father Kelly writes his reflection from the viewpoint of the seafarers he ministers to, whose jobs often require them to spend many weeks away at sea.
And they said to the woman, "Now we no longer believe because of what you told us. We have heard him ourselves, and we know that he really is the Saviour of the world." This morning the captain read to us from the Gospel of John. It was the story of Jesus meeting a woman at the well and talking to her about her life and of all the things that God could offer her, even though she had a very poor opinion of herself because of the life that she had led. The captain said that in churches all over the world, people would be hearing the same reading, and in some way, even though we were miles from anywhere, this reading connected us with the church. It was a very long reading, and I was feeling tired after a particularly difficult night watch. But some things stuck with me, and I've been thinking about them since. The woman at the well was alone. Usually, the gathering of the water was a social occasion, where the woman would meet and spend time chatting and catching up with each other's news. Children would often accompany them, and a vibrant, almost family-like atmosphere would fill the air before they made their way back home. But the woman in the story was alone, not allowed to be a part of the group. I wish we had a name for her, and not just have to refer to her as the woman at the well. But there's no mention of her name. But this was an extraordinary woman. She was a Samaritan, a race of people that the Jews utterly despised as having no claim on their God. And she was obviously an outcast in her own group, looked down upon by her own people. She was ostracized, marked as immoral, an unmarried woman living openly with the sixth in a series of men. But the story teaches us that God loves us in spite of what might be wrong in our lives. He can't help it. God values us enough to come looking for us, to welcome us into a share of his love, and to take delight in us, even if others despise us. As a result of Jesus' conversation, the Samaritan woman, an outcast from her own people, began to understand what this meant. Jesus ministering to those outcasts of the Jewish society, the Samaritans, reveals that all people are valuable to God and that Jesus asks that we demonstrate his love to everyone. I realize more than ever how awful it must be to feel like an outcast, and I will try in this Lent to be aware of how bad we can make people feel, even if we don't necessarily mean to. The last ship I was on, we had one lad in our crew who was not from our country. I don't think we treated him as fairly as we should have done. He was an easy target for our fun and our jibes. We did treat him like an outcast because he wasn't one of us. May God forgive us. Another part of the story struck me too. We're told that Jesus was weary, but he had to sit down by the well. He was thirsty. He was hungry and sent the disciples into town to buy food. That in itself was strange because normally Jews would not eat food that was produced or handled by Samaritans. Perhaps they were already beginning to be influenced by Jesus' kindly attitude towards all who are fashioned in the image of God, making no distinction between race or creed. In other parts of the Gospel, I've read that Jesus was angry, like with the sellers in the temple. He was sad. He wept at the death of his friend. He was tempted in the desert. I have been all of these things, and isn't it wonderful that our God has lived among us in real flesh and blood and has experienced the very things that are part of our everyday lives, and so understands us in our weaknesses and our doubts. I'm off now to do another watch, but I feel better for the gospel I have heard. The other good news is that we will make another port in the morning, and I'll be able to phone or maybe even Skype my family. I miss them so much, and maybe the missing makes me feel like a bit of an outcast.
And thanks there to Father Colum Kelly, a chaplain with the Apostleship of the Sea, for that Lenten reflection. We round off today's programme with a musical meditation for Lent that looks at music described as songs for angels to sing in heaven. It's prepared by Monsignor Philip Whitmore, music historian and rector of the Venerable English College in Rome.
I once knew a piano teacher who said she hoped there would be no music in heaven. She must have spent far too long listening to fistfuls of wrong notes from unwilling pupils. But I must say, I rather hope there will be music in heaven. I say that because I like a lot of the music we have down here. And just think how much more wonderful the music in heaven must be, sung by all those choirs of angels. Believe it or not, the words of the hymn we just heard were written not for a congregation to sing in church, but for choirs of angels to sing in heaven. They were written by John Henry Newman, the great English cardinal, as part of his dramatic poem, The Dream of Gerontius. It's a poem that's best known these days in the version set to music by another English Catholic, Sir Edward Elgar. It's about an old man, Gerontius, who dies and goes to heaven. There he meets his guardian angel, who leads him into the presence of God. As they approach, they hear the angelic choirs singing in the distance. Elgar obviously believed there would be music in heaven, and thankfully he composed this glorious oratorio to give us his idea of how it might sound. As Gerontius and his guardian angel come closer and closer to God's throne, the music builds up towards a tremendous climax. Praise to the holiest in the height, and in the depth be praise. Sing hymns of praise like that forever and ever. Down here, we do our best, but Elgar's music is a bit beyond most of us. Fortunately, other composers have set those same words to music, so we too can sing the Song of the Angels while we're gathered in church. Actually, there are quite a few different tunes to choose from, but the one I've chosen for today's programme is my favourite. Let's listen now to Sir Richard Terry's setting of Cardinal Newman's great hymn of praise. And next time you sing this in church, remember, what you're singing is really the song of the angels in heaven.
And many thanks there to Monsignor Philip Whitmore, music historian, for that musical reflection, produced by Veronica Scaresbrick. And that's all we have time for today. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.